Weird. Warm.
Welcome to Our Weird World. I'm your host, John Henson, and I am over it. It's just been been a rough few days and such. Look, here's the thing. I've talked about before how I have autism spectrum disorder, and one of the things about it is I struggle to articulate how I'm feeling at times. And there's a scientific word for that. It's called alexithymia or something like that. Alexithymia, something like that. Anyway, but it literally means no words for feelings. And God, if I don't struggle with that a lot, you know, like I'll just be sitting there and like, you know, someone will see me and be like, what's wrong? I don't know. How are you feeling? I don't know. And it's real frustrating because my entire personality is built around my ability with words. And then there are times when my brain just absolutely refuses to send the words down out of my mouth hole to explain feelings. And that's real frustrating when you live in a world where you're surrounded by people who are good at talking about feelings. And so, I don't know, man. Just, it's hard sometimes out there. Look, and I realize, like, I don't know, it's not as hard as probably being like some impoverished child in, you know, the Congo or something, where it's like, oh, who's going to come and try to cut our heads off today? So, like, I have that perspective, but also, who cares? You know, it is in my own world where I know what it takes to be a quote unquote normal person. But then, you know, just don't have the brain and the mental capabilities to do that. You know, like, I know that I'm a smart person. All right. People with autism, very smart. All right. Superhero like, but like, not like actual superhero, not like, you know, in a sense, like Spider-Man, you know, he gets bit by a radioactive spider and he just like flying around shooting webs on buildings and saving the day. But like autistic people, they're more like if Peter Parker had gotten bit like one extra time by the radioactive spider. So like, instead of flying around the city saving the day, he just like makes like really elaborate silk art and just like doesn't talk to people. And so like, that's what it's like. And I don't know that people can really relate to that, because a lot of times words and social interactions come easy for people. And it's not me. And it's real frustrating sometimes, you know. It would be like, you know, imagine you had both of your legs chopped off, like all the way off, like up to the hip. All right. And so like, you know what it takes to walk, like, you know how to walk, but then you ain't got no legs. And so you can't walk. And it's kind of like that. Right. And, you know, and maybe you can get some prosthetics, you know, that can help you walk, but you got to work a little bit harder. You got to work abnormal muscles to be able to walk like a normal person. And it takes a little bit more effort. All right. That's my brain. And boy, is it just a grind sometimes. And so, what are we talking about this week? What? lesser known stories from World War II. Let's talk about that instead.
Story time.
Got four stories this week, starting with Alfred Kitchener Gatward, who for some reason went by Kin, who was born on August 28th, 1914 in London. And after working as a journalist and at a wallpaper factory, he then joined the Royal Air Force in 1937 when he was 23. When World War II broke out, Kin was commissioned to fly bombers on low-level raids for the Royal Air Force. In 1942, British intelligence discovered that the Germans were parading down the Champs-Élysées. I don't know how you say that. I think that's how it is. Champs-Élysées, whatever it is, in Paris every day from 1215 to 1245 because along with hating Jews, Nazis were super into parades, which, like, if there was ever just a hallmark for a set of psychopaths. It's like, hey, do you irrationally hate a certain ethnic group of people, but you also enjoy marching in formation every day and playing music and maybe chanting? Then you're an insane person. So the British found out that the Germans were doing this, and with that in mind, Air Chief Marshal Sir Philip Joubert de la Ferté devised a propaganda mission called Operation Squabble to drop the French flag over the Arc de Triomphe as a way to boost French morale and annoy the Nazis while they were on their ridiculous march. Kin, he thought this was a pretty cool idea, so he volunteered to take the mission on. After making several test runs, Kin took off on June 12th, 1942, and despite heavy rains in England, he eventually found sunny skies over Paris. And although he and his navigator encountered some anti-aircraft fire along the way, Kin just, like, shrugged it off, didn't care. He continued on to Paris. And as he circled the Eiffel Tower, however, a bird flew into one of the engines on his plane and, you know, knocked the engine out, but it didn't, you know, take the plane down. There was no, like, you know, Sully Sullenberger landing in the Hudson situation or anything like that. But, you know, he decided he should probably quit screwing around. He flew on to the Ark. And although Kin was flying down the Champs-Élysées at 12:28, which should have been, like, right in the middle of the parade, there were no Germans out. Apparently that day, they were running behind, or maybe their intelligence wasn't exactly intelligent because the parade was still kind of being assembled. Kin didn't care anyway. He's going to go ahead and do this. And so he dropped the flag over the Ark before he flew the plane really low and flew at, like, second story height right down the Champs-Élysées as he and his co-pilot, I think, or whoever, was just machine gunning a nearby square and the building that the Gestapo was occupying, which sent German sentries running for their lives and, like, shaking their fists at him, like, ah, rah, 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 you know, like they were part of some really bad old timey movie. But just a fun little story there of, you know, not like everything in World War II was super violent. Like, both sides just kind of screwed with each other. Our next story here is happened in 1943 when Colonel Joe Duckworth, a former Eastern Airlines pilot from Texas, was training with the British Flying Aces to just help them become better with their Air Force. For whatever reason, though, the British constantly taunted Duckworth, and it got on his nerves because, like, look, there's no way some prissy little Brit, some beans and toast little twerp, was going to be better than a Texan, you know, and Joe Duckworth, I'm a real man. I'm from Texas, you know? And so on July 27th, Duckworth received news that a massive hurricane was on its way to Galveston, Texas, which, if you know anything from history, Galveston, Texas, kind of a hurricane magnet. Duckworth's AT-6 training planes were evacuated out of the area for safety, which amused the British pilots so much that the mocking just became too much for Duckworth to handle. Like the British, I mean, look, British people, they don't get hurricanes. They don't understand what that's all about. And so they thought it was funny that the Americans were evacuating their planes out of Texas because of like some little rainstorm coming in. And so after adamantly insisting that the AT-6s were strong enough to withstand the storm, they were just doing it for safety, Duckworth grabbed Lieutenant Ralph O'Hare and took off into the hurricane without receiving any sort of a official permission to do so. O'Hare, who like wasn't exactly excited to navigate Duckworth into a powerful hurricane, was still forced to ride along as Duckworth in 1943 took this little plane and went right into the eye of this huge hurricane. He dove into the eye somewhere between 4,000 and 9,000 feet, despite violent turbulence, shaking the plane like it was described as like a dog shaking a stick in its mouth. And eventually Duckworth made it into the calm eye, which at that point was 10 miles wide. That's a big eye for a hurricane. And then just for fun, he circled the eye wall a couple of times before flying back out and returning to Texas. And so not only had he then just proven to these British pilots that he was unworthy of their mockery, like he should have been respected. No one knew this, but he and O'Hare had actually become the first two people to successfully fly into the eye of a hurricane. And upon landing, the base's weather officer expressed his displeasure, not necessarily that the fact that Duckworth had gone rogue and flown into an airplane or a hurricane without permission, but because this weather officer hadn't been taken to go do it instead. And so not one to disappoint a crowd, Duckworth refueled the plane and then made a second trip into the storm with this weather officer. So, again, you know, even though it's during World War II, not anything fun, but it's just a fun little story there. This one, not as fun. All right. Marcel Petiot was born on January 17th, 1897 in Auxerre, France, and quickly became one of those problem children. At age 11, he not only brought his father's gun to school and fired it, but he also tried to get a female classmate to have sex with him. I'm guessing not at the same time. I think these were probably two separate incidents because, like, how crazy would that be? Like, just this 11-year-old bringing a gun to school, be like, "Hey, Marie, you have a sex with me. Bang, bang." Whatever. I don't know. Although he was arrested for theft and damaging public property as a teenager, those charges were dropped after he was diagnosed with a mental illness. I mean, because obviously, right? During World War I, Marcel fought for France in the Second Battle of the Aisne? I don't know that word. A-I-S-N-E. Aisne? Aisne? I don't know French, man. Where he was gassed and he then suffered a mental breakdown, which, if you already have a mental illness, then suffering a mental breakdown, not great, all right? He was sent away to recover and was eventually arrested for stealing blankets, morphine, and other supplies. And then after nearly blowing off his own foot with a grenade, a third mental illness diagnosis allowed him to get discharged from service and receive a disability pension. Somehow, through all of this, Marcel Petiot became a doctor. I don't know how you do that, but he completed medical school in 8 months, which also seems highly suspicious, and then began a residence at a mental hospital in Evreux, which, again, seems very suspicious. And maybe it was one of those, like, it takes a one to know one, right? It's like, I'm a crazy, I can treat the crazy people. And I don't know why he's Italian now, but I don't know. It just, like, and maybe, look, it's during wartime. You know, it's in that era between World War I and World War II. You know, all the global economies are in shambles. You know, maybe it was easy. Maybe people just, you know, there was a need for doctors. Maybe they just fast-tracked him through. I don't know. But none of this makes sense. He also got married and had a son. And then after several complaints, you know, he was suspended because I don't want to. I completely skipped a big part of this. Hang on. Let me go back. All right. He completes medical school in 8 months and gets a residence at a mental hospital in the town of Evreux. Meanwhile, while he is in residence, he becomes addicted to painkillers. He performs illegal abortions. and he steals various items from businesses all over town. Even more insane than all of that is that Marcel Petiot became the mayor of Évreux. He is this crazy doctor. He gets elected as mayor, which, I mean, society has done similar silly things, I guess. I also, like, my teeth, my jawline isn't perfectly straight. And so, like, I have, like, a little bit of an overbite, but for some reason this entire episode, my top teeth and my bottom teeth have been, like, hitting together when I talk. And now it's, like, I'm very conscious of it. It really bothers me right now. I just did it again, and I hate it. Like, my teeth are, like, my brain, like, I don't know. It's weird. It's, like, phantom pain, but, like, my teeth hurt now because I keep, like that. And it's just, when I talk, I hate it. And it's just, like, one of those things, like, I always notice with people who have had braces and their jawlines get aligned where everything is, like, perfectly straight and they're, like, and even, like, on the same plane, their bottom teeth and their top teeth line up. And I don't understand how they don't constantly hit their teeth together. And maybe they do and they just don't notice. I don't know. But I never do it and I've noticed it now and it's really going to bother me. I'm probably going to talk with like a weird thing going on. Anyway, let's try to reel this back in. He becomes the mayor of Évreux. He gets married, has a son, but then after several complaints, he was suspended from his mayoral duties, but then was elected as a councilor of Yon Département, which I don't know what any of that means. Probably like a county commissioner or something, like a councilman or something like that. A few weeks later, he was accused of stealing city electricity and was removed from his position. So after that, you know, Marcel moved to Paris and returned to working as a doctor. In 1940, after the Germans began their occupation of France, Marcel began providing false disability certificates to Frenchmen who were drafted into hard labor for Germany. So, like, he's helping French people, you know, forge documents that say that they're physically unable to do work that the Germans are, like, forcing them to do. He also claimed to have joined the resistance, developing weapons that would vaporize German soldiers without leaving any trace of forensic evidence, which sounds really cool. He also planted booby traps in various parts of Paris, and he would conduct secret meetings with Allied commanders. However, not many people believe any of that because what he was actually doing was way worse. They believe that for the duration, and there's a lot of evidence to back this up, for the duration of the German occupation, Marcel was actually providing a false escape route for people to flee the Germans. And that sounds great on the surface if you know what the escape route is. Marcel began claiming that people could get safely to Argentina by way of Portugal if they would pay him 25,000 francs. And for 3 years, Marcel would bring in criminals, other members of the resistance, and Jewish refugees into his office with the promise of helping them get to Argentina out of Europe away from the war. But instead of actually helping them to freedom, Marcel just killed them, right? So, like, I mean, look, he's not wrong. He is providing an escape route for people to flee. That escape is just dying, which probably not what people were hoping for. He told these people that Argentina required all immigrants to get vaccinated before arriving. And instead of providing vaccinations, he just took that opportunity to inject his victims with cyanide, who then just died like a few seconds later. He dumped several bodies into the Seine River, but he eventually just started burning bodies or soaking them in quicklime until they broke down entirely. There was no trace of them left. Marcel, however, he failed to keep his entire operation a secret. And when the Gestapo found out, they sent a guinea pig prisoner named Ivan Dreyfus to try it out. And when Dreyfus ended up vanishing, which, like, what's so crazy about this, like, I don't know what, let's say Ivan Dreyfus is a Jewish person. Seems plausible. You know, the Gestapo captures this Jewish person and then basically just like, hey, we're going to just make you try this out. You know, look, best case scenario, we unwittingly hand you over to someone who's going to send you to freedom. Worst case scenario, I don't know. What's the worst that could happen, my guy? And so they send this dude over, and then they never hear from him again. And look, I don't know how you find out. The Gestapo just assumed that, Dreyfus had been sent off to Argentina. Like, maybe they were like, you know, hey, when he sends you these papers and he sends you on the route, just come back to us instead and let us know how this is all working. And then they think, well, they probably think that he just like totally skipped that step on purpose and just went to Argentina. So they sent another guy, another test guy, informant, and he ended up finding a way back to report. He did not get killed. I don't know what Marcel did with him, but he found it, got reported back to the Gestapo, who then arrested three of Marcel's associates. On March 11th, 1944, Marcel's neighbors complained about an awful odor and a concerning amount of smoke that was always coming out of Marcel's house. Police called the fire department, who then burst into the house and discovered a coal stove in the basement that was stuffed with human remains. Police found the quicklime pit in the backyard, as well as an assortment of suitcases and other pieces of property belonging to all of the people that Marcel had killed. In all, police were just able to put together the remains of 10 people. But like, how long had this been going on? I mean, this was 1944. He had been doing this for at least 4 years. There's no way he had just done 10 people over the course of 4 years, right? For the next several months, Marcel lived with various friends, telling them that the Gestapo was after him for killing Germans, which, not exactly true. After growing out his beard, Marcel changed his name to Henri Valéry and then actually joined the French forces of the interior during the liberation of Paris. And he did so well in this position that he was promoted to captain and oversaw the espionage and prisoner interrogations of the Germans. Eventually, however, the resistance newspaper published an article about Marcel Petiot's fake Argentina smuggling operation. And so Marcel wrote a letter to his defense attorney claiming his innocence. And then with police certain that Marcel was still in Paris, they organized a huge manhunt for him. And then guess who they chose to lead the task force to find Marcel Petiot? They chose Henri Valéry, who was Marcel Petiot in disguise. So the French police, and look, it's after World War II. Everything's in shambles again. I get it. But the French police literally just chose Marcel Petiot to go find himself. However, on October 31st, Marcel was actually identified at a train station by someone else and he was arrested. He was officially charged with 27 murders for profit among 135 other charges. Despite claiming that all of his victims were enemies of France and that most of the people he was charged with murdering were actually doing just fine in Argentina, the French authorities did not believe him. And, you know, Marcel, you know, he was claiming that like he was only working with like German defectors and not like actual French people or Jewish people. And no one believed him for that. He did eventually confess to killing 19 people. He was convicted of killing 26. And then he was sentenced to death and beheaded on the guillotine on May 25th, 1946. Right. Our last story of the day is of the Demon Corps. And this is like just super insane. So towards the end of World War II, the United States was testing several variations of super weapons, atomic bombs, that were aimed at ending the war. And so at the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico, the United States successfully engineered the creation of a subcritical mass of plutonium that, upon activation, would expose this interdimensional wormhole into the supernatural world, which would then send demons out from hell to attack the Axis power leaders, all right? And so in 1946, scientists experimenting with this supercritical or subcritical mass of plutonium, they inadvertently sent this core into supercritical configuration, which released not one, but over 300,000 demons into the laboratory at Los Alamos. And here's the thing, though. Instead of, like, going out into the world and attacking the Japanese, like the U.S. government, like, had, like, programmed them to do or whatever, the demons destroyed the entire laboratory, forcing the government to pretty much, like, halt operations until this core could be stabilized. One particular demon escaped the laboratory and made its way to Arkansas and possessed a pregnant woman. And on August 19th, that woman gave birth to William Jefferson Clinton, who then used his supernatural demon powers to manipulate the 1992 election and begin Satan's final plan for enslaving the human race by turning America into a liberal socialist nation. None of that is true. I hope you realize that. Like, what's crazy, though, is just like there's some people out there be like, yeah, I get it. All right. Demons? Real. Killery? You kidding me? When Bill put his demon-possessed penis inside her, released his demonic DNA into her, turned her into Killery. All right? The Clintons, leaders of the Illuminati. This all makes sense. It does. None of that happened. Although, like, Bill Clinton really was born in 1946 when this took place. That's the only true part of the story. No, the real story is... Rather, like, as part of their plan to bomb Japan to end World War II, the United States was actually manufacturing several plutonium cores to be made into nuclear bombs. Several of those bombs were held at the Los Alamos National Laboratory, and Major General Leslie R. Groves Jr., who was overseeing the lab's efforts, wrote to the government that one particular core would be ready by August 17th. Hiroshima and Nagasaki were bombed on August 6th and August 9th, respectively. And then Japan surrendered on August 15th. And so, like, this particular core not even being used, but the United States decided to keep preparing bombs for, you know, like, just in case. Russia, right? So on August 21st, scientist Harry Daglian was conducting an experiment on one of the cores to test how it reflected neutrons, because that's an important thing to know, I guess. Because the core was designated to be 5% away from reaching critical mass at all times, which doesn't seem like a big buffer, there was a razor-thin safety margin when working on it. And then Daglian, working alone, placed the core within a stack of tungsten carbide bricks, which, as we all know, very neutron-reflective. Those things... Man, like, look, if there's something that I'm going to get to just deflect some neutrons, I'm going to get me a tungsten carbide brick, right? Obviously. But each new brick that Daglian added to the stack brought the core closer to 100% criticality. Unfortunately, Daglian then accidentally dropped a brick directly onto the core. You don't want to actually touch the core. You just want to kind of... get all up in its bubble with these bricks. But he dropped the brick onto the core, which then sent it into super criticality, which obviously is way worse than just regular criticality. Although Daglian acted quickly and moved the brick off the core, he had already been blasted with just a crazy unhealthy amount of radiation, so much so that he died 25 days later from radiation poisoning. On May 21st, 1946, Louis Slotin and seven other lab personnel were conducting another neutron reflecting experiment on this same exact core. Slotin was showing another scientist how to conduct the test, which would then clear the way for the core to be used as part of the Operation Crossroads nuclear test in the Pacific that was being scheduled for the following month. Slotin, who preferred doing things his own way, he's one of those rogue, crazy guys. And by that, I mean, he would do these experiments in blue jeans and cowboy boots instead of, you know, like proper laboratory hazmat suits. But he was showing another scientist, Alvin C. Graves, how to do it. So Slotin started by taking two half spheres of beryllium, which is a neutron reflector. Duh, you know this. And then placed them around the core using nothing but a thumb hole at the top of one of the spheres and a screwdriver, which definitely is not protocol for this, to keep the beryllium from actually touching the core. because obviously if they two touch, it sets off this chain reaction. We don't want that to happen. Well, scientists actually referred to this method as tickling the dragon's tail, which is great. I like that. And so obviously things did not go well. As Slotin lowered the top sphere, his screwdriver slipped less than an inch. All right. What, like, honestly may not even have been noticeable to anyone except Slotin, who at that point knew he had messed up, because at that point the spheres touched the core, which then caused this bright blue flash to illuminate the room and emit this intense heat wave right through Slotin's body. The core became super critical, again, the bad kind of critical, and unleashed this blast of radiation throughout the room that only lasted for half of a second before Slotin readjusted the screwdriver and stopped the reaction. But by then, he had received 1,000 rads of neutron radiation and 1.14 grays of gamma ray radiation, which, I mean, look, you guys know this. We operate in rads and grays all the time. I mean, it's how we measure everything, right? It basically is a lot more than you should ever receive in a lifetime. Slotin, however, just calmly walked out of the room and then just projectile vomited everywhere. He was rushed to the hospital where he began receiving blood transfusions. But over the next 9 days, his condition worsened. It started with diarrhea and then progressed to these massive blisters all over his skin, intestinal paralysis, gangrene, and internal radiation burns. Like, that's insane that this stuff can, like, burn you from the inside out. He died 9 days later. So this core, which has had two supercritical accidents, came to be known as the Demon Core. It ended up killing at least six people. And it was eventually melted down and recycled for use in other future nuclear weapons that the United States developed. And that is the end of our stories. There you go. Some lesser known stories from World War II. I mean, none of those stories really had anything directly to do with the actual war, like no crazy battles, no soldier hijinks or anything like that. But just, you know, some stories that, you know, took place because of World War II and just, you know, don't get the attention that, you know, they may otherwise receive just out in the regular world. But let's see what we learned today.
What did we learn?
Number one, Joe Duckworth, the first person to successfully fly into the eye of a hurricane, and he did it because he didn't like British people making fun of him. Number two, Marcel Petiot, a French serial killer who was like, "Hey, I send you to Argentina. Just kidding, kill you with cyanide." I don't know what accent that is. French, who cares? Number three, the Demon Core, not an actual supernatural wormhole opener who somehow became the reason Bill Clinton was a demonic person. I don't know. It's something I made up. But it was this radioactive plutonium core that killed at least six people, because mostly because at least two different scientists were not being very safe around it and nearly caused just something crazy to happen. Yeah, I don't know. Nukes are fun, I guess. Next week on Our Weird World, we head back to serial killer land with three stories about some German serial killers. Always fun to go and check in on what those crazy Germans are doing. We are going to look at the stories of Fritz Haarmann, Adolf Seefeld, and Rudolf Pleyel. It's going to be about what you expect from Germany. So get ready for that. And maybe I'll be in a better mood next week. We'll see. That's going to be it. Thank you all for listening. Keep telling all your friends. And hey, here's the thing. Some of you might be like, "Well, dude, I don't know how to tell my friends about this show." And so what you do is, just next time you're in the car with someone, put on this podcast And then they're going to be like, what are you listening to? Are you mentally unstable? And then you can choose to answer that question however you want. But then you just be like, no, this is a really cool podcast from this guy that I know. Or maybe I don't know him. I don't know. And you could just be like, you should listen to it too. We should listen to it together. And this will be a thing that we do. And then now that's how you tell people about the show. And that's how it grows. And so, yeah, I don't know. Just keep it weird. Get out the way, pretty boy coming through. Me and my crew, we swaggin' in the room. Girls on me heavy, 'cause I look so sexy. Yellow diamond shawty in the club, straight flexin'. I'm looking for a yellow bone, long-haired star. Thick in the hips, come get in my car. You party with a star, we take off, go to Mars. Pretty boy, take off in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. I'm pretty boy swaggin' in the club. I feel sexy, no homo. No homo, shawty, but my chest is straight flexin'. Tatted on my neck, shawty said she choose me. She got nice titties and a big fat booty. Took her to my condo, let the girl strip. Then she got naked, then she pretty girl dipped. Damn, I like the way lil mama shake that ass. She pretty girl dancing while I pretty boy swag. This right here is my swag. All the girls are on me. Damn. Everybody pay attention. This right here is my pretty boy swag. Pretty boy swag. Hey. Pretty boy swag. Hey. Pretty boy swag.